But now it is time for the Earth. First, update all the environmental news you can use. Uncle Dennis here in the Free Radio Studios on Thursday, February 19th. I'd like to remind you that having a pencil and paper handy is a good thing, especially because of all the dates, times, places, email, web addresses, you name it, that comes up in this show. You might want to just be prepared to take some notes. Let's start off with announcements. Here in Santa Cruz, the California Native Plant Society, Santa Cruz County Chapter, is having a habitat restoration this Saturday, February 21st. It's starting a little earlier than usual. They're starting at 9 a.m. instead of their normal 10. I'll tell you why in a minute. 9 a.m. to noon at Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. Linda writes, we'll scout out some broom sites today, that is French broom, and take inventory on what still needs to get done. We'll head back to the ranch before noon and meet up with others for a celebratory lunch. Lee Summers, Quail Hollow stalwart naturalist, will be hosting a volunteer recognition luncheon for all the park's volunteers. Come hear about future plans for the park and share stories about our achievements. How to get to Quail Hollow? Well, go up Graham Hill Road out of Santa Cruz. When you come down into Felton, turn right at the first light on East Ziani. Go 2 miles, turn left on Quail Hollow Road. About a half mile up on the right is the entrance. And they're asking you to meet in the gravel parking lot on the left side of the entrance road about 9 a.m. The Habitat Restoration Team is a volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. Their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80. Wear comfortable layered clothing, bring something to drink, and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine. It's going to be shine. But if things get particularly unpleasant, they'll call it a day. Tools are provided. Bring gloves and that water. Though I do think they have water at Quail Hollow, but you might want some in your backpack. Got any questions? Contact the program leader, Linda. Her number, 831-462-4041. That's 831-462-4041. You could email her at redwoodrn. That's REDWDRN. At packbell.net or visit the website at www.cruisecnps.org. Mountain Justice Spring Break is coming up March 7th through 14th in Southwest Virginia. I've told you about this before. This is their fifth annual Renew Collective, and Sam's hosts of the Mountain Justice Spring Break in Virginia, March 7th through the 14th, somewhere in Southwest Virginia. Don't have an update on where that is. Should be a great gathering. I don't even have a webpage to figure it out. So they're going to be doing a whole lot of stuff out there around mountaintop removal and getting in touch with the folks out there in Southwest Virginia. And the 2015 Earth First Winter Rendezvous is happening this weekend, February 20th through the 23rd, down in Santa Barbara. Go to the webpage, www.efoc2015.wordpress.com, to get exact directions on how to get there. They should be posted by now. I didn't check. Sorry about that. Once again, www.efoc2015.wordpress.com. Probably a little late to email them because they're probably on site already. Anyway, the Winter Earth First Rendezvous starting tomorrow. If you're going to go, come prepared to camp. Bring as much of your own water as possible. No dogs or pets except service animals. No drugs or alcohol. I guess it's going to be a pretty dull event. Come with the intention to learn, to organize, and build. Be respectful of the land and those around you. Breakfast and dinner provided. Bring your own dishware. They're asking a sliding scale donation of $20 to $40, but no one will be turned away for lack of funds. And directions to the event will be posted to the website, www.efoc2015.wordpress.com. Also coming up on Saturday is a celebration with Eric McDavid, just released Eco Prisoner. It's going to be happening February 21st, I believe that's Saturday at 6 p.m. at 3030B Mission Street in San Francisco, California. And East Bay Prisoner Support Station 40 and Sacramento Prisoner Support are all sponsoring this. Eric McDavid will be talking about his case. The Sacramento Prisoner Support, along with Eric's lawyers, will be contributing to the discussion, live music, and food. And they're trying to raise money to help out Eric. So go to www.youcaring.com/Eric McDavid and pass that on. Once again, Celebration with Eric McDavid is Saturday night, February 21st at 6 p.m., 3030B Mission Street, San Francisco, California. Have a good time up there. Here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field. More than 600 of America's last wild buffalo through hunting or slaughter have been destroyed this year. Yellowstone National Park has facilitated the slaughter of hundreds of the animals who are a national treasure that we had entrusted them with protecting and that they use as their symbol. As we have been reporting, Yellowstone has been extremely secretive about capture and slaughter operations this year. Buffalo Field Campaign has pressed them repeatedly for media tours and timely information with little success. Independent journalists and mainstream media have also been applying pressure, also with little success. The American Civil Liberties Union has stepped in and things are changing. Buffalo Field Campaign and independent journalist Christopher Ketchum, who is currently with us doing another story for the Buffalo, are currently being represented by the Wyoming ACLU. Last week, the ACLU sent a letter of demand to Yellowstone National Park seeking full and unfettered access to the Stevens Creek bison trap. The day after this letter was sent, Yellowstone announced they would conduct a guided media tour of the trap site. This tour took place yesterday. It was brutal. 2 days prior to the tour, Buffalo Field Campaign vigilantly watched the trap from our usual faraway distance. Buffalo were being tortured, run through the squeeze chutes in preparation for being shipped to slaughter the following day. Buffalo Field Campaign was able to document buffalo in the long, skinny chute, and to our horror, we got footage of 67 buffalo being left in this hall of terrors overnight. Park rangers left the facility while buffalo were left crammed in this space, and I guess it would have been convenient for the next morning's loadings. We followed the trailer out of the Gardner Basin all the way to Big Timber. Buffalo hair was flying out of the trailer as we trailed it. No buffalo allowed yet on this amazing landscape, but they still planted their seeds of presence. We slid our way between the Montana Department of Livestock and the stock trailer, much to the Montana Department of Livestock's chagrin. We followed them past Big Timber, then pulled back, knowing they were heading a much further away, and we needed to be back in Gardner for the media tour of the trap. We pulled a U-turn at an exit with a sign for a prairie dog town. Prairie dogs have a symbiotic relationship with buffalo. One day they will reunite all over this land. A small trailer and another double-decker semi left the trap on Wednesday morning. During the media tour, Buffalo Field Campaign volunteer Sam Estrada asked Park Ranger Brian Helms, who works at the trap, if they ever keep buffalo in the squeeze chute overnight. Helms said no. Sam informed him that this wasn't true, that they did it the night before, and that Buffalo Field Campaign had video footage to prove it. Helms was silenced. It was brutal and intensely heartbreaking to see the buffalo in here, but important to show this to you, to everyone, so that we can take the wrongness in and turn it into something else, into representation for these sacred, gentle giants. One thing that will haunt us for the rest of our lives was hearing the sounds, the grunting of yearling buffalo in a small square pen calling out for their moms, and there was no call back because their mothers were no longer there. The buffalo and other pens were going round and round in circles, slamming into each other, unnaturally harming one another in their terror and confusion. Park Service employees who were guiding us on this tour were disturbingly comfortable with even defending their participation in the maltreatment of buffalo. They have essentially become the Montana Department of Livestock. Buffalo harassment, abuse, and slaughter has become business as usual for them, and they attempt to justify their actions as if it was what the Park Service was born to do. The buffalo's horrific treatment is sanctioned by MCA Montana Civil Code of 81-2-120, a Montana law that puts the Montana Department of Livestock in charge of wild bison and led to the creation of the Interagency Bison Management Plan. While Yellowstone National Park is responsible for their own actions, the IBMP would not exist if it were not for MCA 81-2-120, and this law must be repealed. The Buffalo Field Campaign is at P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana 59758. Once again, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana 59758. Go to their webpage at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org for all this information. They also have videos and pictures you might want to take a look at after you sit down. And if you have any questions, give them a call at 406-646-0070. And Native Americans gathered in Montana to protest the slaughter of Yellowstone bison in this story by Laura Zuckerman of Reuters, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Native American activists gathered in Montana's capital on Tuesday to protest the deaths of hundreds of Yellowstone National Park bison killed this year to ease the worries of Montana ranchers about a cattle disease carried by many park buffalo. The demonstration marked a week of protests over federal state management of Yellowstone bison that entails culling the herd each winter when some animals cross from the park into neighboring Montana in search of food. This is a new beginning to protect the bison and other wildlife in Indian country, Jimmy St. Goddard, a self-described spiritual leader of the Blackfeet tribe in Montana, said in a telephone interview from outside the Montana capital in Helena. He was among dozens who gathered to call for an end to the slaughter of Yellowstone buffalo, which are a major attraction for the 3 million people who visit the park. They are the largest purebred herd of wild buffalo in the United States. The iconic humpbacked animals once roamed by the tens of millions west of the Mississippi until hunting campaigns reduced their numbers to fewer than 50 that found safe harbor in Yellowstone in the early 20th century. Under an agreement between the park and states surrounding Yellowstone, Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho, hundreds of straying bison can be killed each year through slaughter and regulated hunting. The practice has inflamed bison advocates like the Buffalo Field Campaign and some members of tribes in Montana and the Pacific Northwest. In a sign of tribal dissent surrounding the issue, other members of the same tribes annually exercise treaty rights to hunt bison that migrate into Montana from Yellowstone. St. Goddard's position on bison was not formally sanctioned by the Blackfeet Nation, leaders said. The number of culled bison so far this year is more than 330, with most loaded onto trucks and sent to slaughter. Bison managers are seeking a cull of 900 of the animals from a herd of estimated 4,900. Rick Wallen, leading wildlife biologist for Yellowstone's bison program, said in a statement this week that cutting bison numbers is required to accommodate concerns expressed by surrounding states that they really don't want wild bison outside the national park. Culling aims to address fears by Montana ranchers that bison exposed to brucellosis, a disease from cows that can cause them to abort their young, will infect cattle that graze near the park. Though, I might point out, there has never been a documented case of transmission of brucellosis from a buffalo to a cow. And Sea Shepherd Conservation Society has tripled the record for the longest sea chase of a poacher as it enters the third month of pursuit. As of yesterday, the Sea Shepherd ship Bob Barker tripled the record for the longest sea chase of a poaching vessel, marking its 63rd day of pursuit of the Interpol wanted Nigerian flag toothfish poaching vessel Thunder. The previous record was held by the Australian patrol vessel Southern Supporter, which pursued an Uruguayan vessel Viarsa 1 for 21 days in the year 2003. The milestone comes just one day after the Bob Barker logged a second full month since it first intercepted Thunder on the Banzari Bank in Antarctica. Captain of the Bob Barker, Peter Hammerstedt, stated, "We first intercepted the Thunder on December 17th. For 2 months, we have ensured that this, the most notorious of all toothfish poaching vessels, has not been able to kill any more of the Antarctica's precious toothfish." In the process, we have cost the criminals behind this operation millions of dollars in lost profits. Sea Shepherd is sending a very loud message to the poachers who continue to threaten this region. Your criminal activity ends here. On Saturday, fellow Sea Shepherd ship, the Sam Simon, rendezvoused with the Bob Barker in the Melville Bank on the South Indian Ocean in order to resupply the Bob Barker with food. With the resupply operation complete, both Sea Shepherd ships are now in pursuit of Thunder. The Bob Barker now has enough fuel and food to maintain the pursuit of the Thunder until the poaching vessel returns to port and is handed over to authorities. The Sam Simon is carrying aboard 72 kilometers of illegal gill net abandoned by Thunder when it first fled from the Bob Barker. The nets will be used as evidence against the Thunder to aid in its prosecution. The Thunder is the first of three poaching vessels that have been intercepted by Sea Shepherd ships during the organization's 11th Southern Ocean Defense Campaign, Operation Icefish. On February 2nd, the Sam Simon intercepted two Interpol wanted poaching vessels, the Yongding and the Kunlun, in Australian waters in the Southern Ocean. Both vessels had illegal fishing gear on their decks at the time they were intercepted. The Sam Simon subsequently engaged in a high seas pursuit of the Kunlun. On February 8th, Captain Sid Chakravarti reported that he and the crew of the Sam Simon had successfully chased the poaching vessel out of its hunting grounds in the Southern Ocean. Commencing in December of last year, Operation Icefish is Sea Shepherd's first Southern Ocean defense campaign to target illegal, unregulated, and unreported fishing operators in the waters of Antarctica. And for more information, you can go to www.seashepherd.org.au. That's www.seashepherd.org.au. And a wolf shot by an Utah hunter was Echo, the famed Grand Canyon wanderer, in this story by Laura Zuckerman, editing by Cynthia Johnson and Sandra Mahler, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. A gray wolf killed last year by an Utah hunter was Echo, a female that had garnered international attention after roaming from Wyoming to become the first of the protected animals seen at the Grand Canyon in Arizona in 70 years, U.S. wildlife managers said recently. News that the lone wolf spotted last fall near the north rim of the Grand Canyon was the same animal later killed in Utah by a hunter who said he mistook it for a coyote ignited outrage among wildlife advocates. It's tragic that Echo traveled over 500 miles only to be cut down by an incredibly irresponsible coyote hunter, said Bethany Cotton, wildlife program director for Wild Earth Guardians. Authorities have not released the name of the coyote hunter who in December reported to Utah wildlife officers that he had accidentally shot and killed a radio-collared wolf near the border with Arizona. It is illegal to kill wolves without a special permit in the lower 48 states where most wolves are protected under the U.S. Endangered Species Act. Wolves in just two states, Idaho and Montana, are not on federal list of endangered and threatened species and can be legally hunted. Federal wildlife officials said an investigation into the incident is ongoing. Echo was the first gray wolf to appear in the national park in Arizona since the 1940s, when the last of the creatures were killed as part of an extensive eradication campaign, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service said. The carcass of the wolf was confiscated by federal authorities who submitted it to the University of Idaho for genetic testing that confirmed it was the same animal first collared in Wyoming in January of 2014 and seen later that year at the Grand Canyon, Fish and Wildlife Service spokesman Steve Sagan said. Gray wolves have been at the center of a bitter debate in the western states since several dozen were released in Yellowstone National Park and the Central Idaho Wilderness in the mid-1990s in a push by U.S. wildlife managers to restore an animal that had been hunted, trapped, and poisoned to near extinction in the northern Rockies. Ranchers and hunters in the region blame wolves for preying on livestock and big-game animals like elk favored by sportsmen. Conservationists argue wolves are restoring public rangelands and mountain forests damaged from overgrazing by deer and elk, whose populations have swelled in the absence of natural predators. And the California Department of Fish and Wildlife has won a lawsuit defending an attack on their hatcheries. The California Department of Fish and Wildlife was victorious in the 3rd District Court of Appeals recently when the court upheld the agency's statewide environmental impact report on its hatchery and fish stocking program. In 2006, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife embarked on a years-long multi-million-dollar public process to create a statewide environmental impact report for the hatchery and stocking program, which had been providing recreational fishing opportunities along with economics opportunities for related businesses to California's anglers for more than 100 years. Once it was completed and filed in January of 2010, two groups attacked the environmental impact report in the California Department of Fish and Wildlife Program in Superior Court, alleging that the EIR was insufficient under the California Environmental Quality Act standards. They lost that case and then appealed that loss. The court found that the measures adopted by the California Department of Fish and Wildlife in 2010 are comprehensive and sufficiently protective of the state's natural resources while providing recreational opportunities to anglers. The court found the California Department of Fish and Wildlife and against the plaintiffs on all CEQA allegations. This victory by CDFW means hatchery operations will continue to benefit anglers across the state without further modification, unless the losing parties choose to appeal again. The California Department of Fish and Wildlife has been implementing the protective measures since their adoption in 2010. In a related action, the court determined that three proposed measures in the EIR regarding its Fishing in the City program and the issuance of private stocking permits would require the California Department of Fish and Wildlife to undertake a regulatory process as governed by the Administrative Procedures Act. Both the Fishing in the City and private stocking programs will continue to operate using existing regulations, and the California Department of Fish and Wildlife will work collaboratively with the aquaculture industry to ensure any future regulations proposed regarding each program will protect California's natural resources. For further information, you can visit the California Department of Fish and Wildlife's website at www.wildlife.ca.gov. And U.S. wildlife managers mark a population rise for the rare red wolf, Mexican gray wolves. In this story by Laura Zuckerman, editing by Daniel Wallace and Sandra Mahler, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. The number of imperiled wolves found only in the American Southwest climbed to 109 in 2014, marking the fourth consecutive year that the population of Mexican gray wolves has risen by at least 10%, federal wildlife managers said recently. Wild Mexican wolves were believed to be all but extinct in the United States in 1998 when the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service began reintroducing the animal to its native range. At that point, there had been no sightings of the wolves, which are native to western Mexico's Sierra Madre Mountains in the wild in the United States since the 1970s, said Benjamin Tuggle, the service's Southwest Regional Director. Government and tribal biologists seeking to restore the creature in Arizona and New Mexico estimated in 1982 that the recovery number needed for the survival of Mexican wolves, a smaller separate subspecies of the gray wolf found elsewhere in the United States, was no fewer than 100 animals. Although there is still much to be done, reaching this milestone is monumental, Tuggle said in a statement about the 2014 annual survey showing a minimum of 109 Mexican wolves, up from 83 at the end of the previous year, and more than double the population found in the two states in 2010. Tuggle said the federal, state, and tribal team overseeing the recovery of the Mexican wolf began using a technique last spring known as cross-fostering, which involves placing genetically viable pups into similarly aged litters of established packs in a bid to improve the genetics of the wolves. He said the new methodology, combined with population growth, bode well for the future of the rare animal. The Fish and Wildlife Service said last month the Mexican wolves will be allowed to roam more in the U.S. Southwest, but could be marked for death if they preyed too heavily on elk and deer prized by hunters. The Mexican wolf, I suppose they should be eating cows and sheep. Well, I don't know either. The Mexican wolf, considered one of the most imperiled mammals in North America, has been at the center of the conflict that has pitted ranchers and hunters against conservationists who are petitioning the government for more measures to ensure the animal makes a strong comeback. In Mexico, the animals are believed to have been extinct in the wild since the 1980s. In 2014, wildlife managers there announced the first litter of wild pups to be born in the wild since then, local media said, following reintroduction programs. And in a first for a fish, the Oregon chub has been removed from the endangered species list. In this story by Courtney Sherwood, editing by Cynthia Johnson and Sandra Mahler, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. For the first time, a fish has been removed from the U.S. Endangered Species Act protection as federal officials declared on Tuesday that a tiny shimmering minnow found only in an Oregon valley was no longer in danger of extinction. Millions of the 2-inch fish, the Oregon chub, once swam in waters surrounding western Oregon's Willamette River. But their number sharply declined over the past century as wetlands were drained for development and due to predation by non-native fish like largemouth bass. Fewer than 1,000 remained in just 8 wetlands in 1993 when the chub gained endangered species protection. Today, more than 150,000 chubs are estimated in 80 sites along the river valley because of recovery efforts like restored water flows, floodplain reconstruction, and stocking in private ponds. The fish's resurgence shows that habitat improvement and species recovery efforts can succeed even in areas heavily impacted by agriculture and urban development, said Paul Henson, Oregon supervisor with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. This shows the public that you can recover a species and do it in a way that works with local communities in a positive way as opposed to being a big contentious event, Henson said. The Oregon chub is not fished commercially, and improvements to its habitat could be made at minimal cost to private landowners, both factors that aided its efforts to boost its population, said Paul Shearer, leader of the Native Fish Project for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. State officials had been cheering the Oregon chub's recovery as other fish, including a trout and a sucker, also showed signs of recovery under the Endangered Species Act, Shearer said. It wasn't really a race, but we were feeling a little pressure, thinking maybe we won't be the first, Shearer said. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Director Dan Ash was scheduled to formally announce the removal of the Oregon minnow from the endangered species list on an event on Tuesday, but his flight from Washington, D.C. was canceled due to snow. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening right here at Free Radio Santa Cruz at 9 o'clock. If you'd like to hear a rebroadcast, please tune in tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock right here on 101.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. You can also listen in Monday nights at 9:30 on 90.3 KRFP Radio Free Moscow, Idaho. Or tune into the yegradio.wordpress.com webcast, 2 p.m. on Saturdays or 10 a.m. on Sundays, Mountain Time. And when you get to that webpage, click on search, and that will take you to where the actual radio is. And that is a broadcast of Free Radio Edmonton. And you can also go to radioforall.net. There you can listen online, or you can download this or previous editions of the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is a presentation of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening, and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.